Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. We're here at Roberta's. It's a beautiful, sunny spring day in Brooklyn. And I'm your host, Kathy Irway. And today, we're going to talk a lot about very, very intelligent things. We have an intelligent guest out on the show today who is just coming out with a book tomorrow. It launches tomorrow, but I have a copy in my hands. And it's called Culinary Intelligence, The Art of Eating Healthy and Really Well. It's Peter Kaminsky. How are you?
I'm great.
Thanks. So I would like to read a little segment from your book because you talk about eating well, eating healthy, and one chapter, chapter 5, is called The Joy of Cooking. And you write, you can read every diet book in the store. You can shop locally, seasonally, sustainably. You can count calories and avoid franchises. But only cooking leaves you fully in charge of what you eat and how it is prepared. It is the surest way to put culinary intelligence into practice. Very well said.
Why, thank you.
So what is culinary intelligence?
Culinary intelligence is a way of eating. It's my way of eating. That I before I had a name for it, I had a way of doing it, which is basically, if you want to maintain a healthy weight and a healthy diet, don't eat processed foods. Buy the best, most full-flavored ingredients you can afford, and from that follows, usually, sustainable and local, and cook or live with someone who does. Because only in that way are you going to get fresh, flavorful ingredients that are express their peak flavor when they're cooked well. And if you do that, you're not going to have to compensate for lack of flavor and pleasure and texture with a lot of salt and condiments and fat and just calorie-boosting empty calories.
But what if I get just, you know, some really prime bacon that's really flavorful, smoky, humanely raised pork produced bacon, and I eat that every day. Is that intelligent?
I love bacon.
I know. You wrote the book on that, Pig Perfect.
I just did a bacon cookbook. Here's the thing about bacon. Bacon's one of those things that is used to rescue inferior ingredients. When you go into some, you know, burger joint or, you know, whatever, and it's something, you know, drowning in cheese and a lot of bacon, you got to wonder, what was the poor, inadequate food that got drowned in it? I look at bacon as a seasoning.
Yeah.
It has beautiful flavor. It's got a lot of umami. It's got great crunchy texture. It's salty. It's got the complexity of aged meat. And used sparingly, it can really wake up a lentil salad or any salad. It's nice with some pasta. I mean, I use bacon as much as I use any condiment or seasoning in my kitchen.
Right. So this is coming from an author who has written so many different cookbooks. You've co-written cookbooks such as Seven Fires, Grilling the Argentine Way with Frances Melman. You've written Pig Perfect, as I mentioned. You were a longtime columnist for the New York Times, and you wrote the outdoors column, the fishing and hunting column. So you've had a long and storied career in food writing, and now you're turning, and you must get so many freebies from restaurants whenever you walk in. How can you resist and cook at home?
Well, I should ask you that, because that's how I discovered you. You had the most sensible blog on the web when you were not eating out in New York. I said, she gets it. How can you not eat in restaurants all the time? You know, I turn around and say, how can you eat in them all the time? Anybody I know who's a professional eater knows that it's really tough. I mean, the stuff's delicious. So no one should feel sorry for you for like foregoing the pleasure of a meal. But restaurants really are there to blow your mind in the next 2 hours. Mm. And if that takes shock and awe amounts of butter, you know, and cream, that's what's going to have. So restaurants, and I do offer some guidance for if you do eat in restaurants, what to do.
Yeah.
But restaurants are not, is not the first line of defense for a healthful diet.
Okay. Fair enough. And you came to this, the idea for this book, was that sparked by your weight, growing, you know, health issues?
Yeah. I was, I got a 34-inch waist now. I had what I would call an overly self-generous 38-inch waist. That usually means you're 39 or 40.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I weigh,
you call it your occupational hazard.
In the, well, that the is. Yeah. If you write cookbooks and, you know, restaurant reviews, you're going to bulk up. Unless you've got a really great secret anorexic, you know, strategy. you're just going to put on a lot of weight. So where were we going with this question, though?
What happened?
Yeah, so
to...
So I had to get life insurance, you know, had to re-up, and I had an exam. It turned out I had high blood sugar. I was pre-diabetic, and my doctor said, this is bad. Mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, you're not there yet. Maybe you could lick it. You got to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was selling me my life insurance had the same problem. And he said, look, don't eat any white stuff. I mean, we've all heard that. You know, lay off or cut back on the drinkies, desserts, and you're going to lose weight. Well, broadly speaking, that's what I did. You know, I cut out white flour, white pasta, although I do have something to say about that later.
Okay.
Potatoes, French fries, my rule for drinking, because no drinking is no living, the way I look at it. It was two glasses of wine, one cocktail, or one beer, but that was it. And in that time that I made that change, I also made 3 trips to South America to write a book that was largely about eating meat and drinking wine. And I wrote a dessert cookbook with the great Michel Richard. And I think I took off 15 to 20 pounds, those first initial 15 to 20 pounds. Well, that puts me in the realm, although I was eating rarefied stuff, it puts me in the realm of most dieters. You can lose weight, but how do you keep it off? And I think it's only by changing the way you eat.
It sounds like a Mission Impossible.
Well, there's a lot of awful, as you know, a lot of awful good, flavorful ingredients out there that are just delicious. And if you cook them well, if you got a good crust on your meat or a nice succulent falling apart braise, you know, if you caramelize your vegetables, if you buy vegetables that are really fresh and really in season, no chef in the world could add the amount of taste and flavor that those things have naturally. And once you start cooking that way, I found it wasn't that hard to continue.
So, and I got to say, you look great. You really walk the walk and talk the talk that you talk throughout this book. You came to meet me the other day and was, you know, biking in this not very nice, you know, clammy, cloudy day. So, well done.
Yeah,
to that.
Well, New York is an ally, you know.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of walking. And so, tell me a little bit about this flavor per calorie idea that you describe in the book. It's... let me try to describe it. It's the idea of having the most flavor per calorie in each ingredient.
Exactly. If you have really full flavored ingredients, you can get the most bang for your buck, the most sensual bang for your buck. Then every calorie that you eat will deliver both, you know, pleasure and satisfaction. If your ingredients or your cooking technique cannot deliver flavor per calorie, on goes the mayo, on goes the butter, on goes the...
Or the third portion or something.
Well, that's the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did an interesting experiment. Most diet books don't start out telling you that it's fine to eat steak, beer, chocolate, and cheese. However, I like all of those things. I wasn't about to give them up. So with the guys from Frankie's, Frank Castronovo and Frank Valsinelli, and some friends, food writers, civilian students, we did a taste test of seven producers, grass, grain-fed, various degrees of age, of beef. Yeah, strips and ribeyes. Blind taste test. Now, the one that won, hands down, was an aged grass all the way ribeye from the Rosencrantz Farm in the Lake Districts of New York State. It's just astonishing beef. You know, funky, chewy, full flavor, succulent, everything you want.
And not as fatty? Not as marbled?
The ribeye is as marbled. I'm not afraid of fat. Mm-hmm. Just on all fat all the time.
Yeah.
The kind of fat that a grass-eating steak develops, you know, one of its fatty acids is conjugated linoleic acid, which is, you know, rather helpful. You need fat. Mm-hmm. Without fat, we don't have brains. Without fat, we're a bunch of plants. I mean, that's how human beings are. But at any rate, three slices of that steak, you're plenty satisfied.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, not to single out Outback, they're just the first one to come to mind. Yep. If you go to some chain steak place, you're going to eat a whole 1 pound steak or pound and a half steak, you will not have the same amount of beefy satisfaction. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll keep eating because you want it, but it just can't deliver it. And likewise, we did this, with chocolate. I like chocolate, but a piece of really good dark chocolate, you know, that's got that flavor of cherries from the ripe beans and stuff, and the bitterness. You know, a little square of that is going to satisfy
intense,
you.
Yeah.
A whole, you know, a little square of Scharfenberger. I have a reason for saying that. It's going to satisfy you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a whole square of a whole bar of Hershey's, also, which also owns Scharfenberger, is not going to satisfy you. So, you know, they have more flavor per calorie. They deliver more umami and other satisfying flavors. And you're going to be happier with less. Beer, you know, one 6 point. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Is going to give you a real great bitter, bubbly beer feeling.
I'm thirsty now.
A light beer, man. You're going to keep drinking it, looking for it's a beer-like experience, but after six of them, you still want a beer. So, flavor per calorie is just using common sense to find the best ingredients and prepare them in the most flavor-enhancing ways, and less will get you further.
Was there anything that you totally gave up during your diet?
I gave up French fries.
Oh, was that hard?
French fries. No, what's hard?
Because they're not that flavor per calorie, delicious.
No,
to me, I don't know.
They're salt.
They're
and they're
a vessel
fat.
For ketchup.
Yeah, and the crispy fat. Don't discount that. People go for that.
But you can get a crisp on a vegetable too, right?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, you mentioned this parsnip thing that you made once, but it was like kind of like brick chicken.
Brick. I want to learn how to make that.
Okay,
Dan Barber. The wonderful chef and amazing writer.
Stone Barnes.
Yeah. Is a buddy, and we've done a lot of things together. And I ate there with Kelly Brownell from the Rudd Center for Diet and Obesity a few weeks ago with my wife and a professor, a nutritionist from Minnesota. And Dan blew it out. And one of the things is he brings out a real knobby parsnip to the table and shows
unpeeled,
it to you.
Yeah.
And then next to it is this parsnip that he's peeled and he's put a weight on, just like you do if, well, in a burger joint where they put, but just like you do with chicken under a brick, the Italian dish. And he cooked it at low heat for a real long while. Well, it gets soft.
And concentrated.
And concentrated and sweet and caramelized brown on the outside, and Mr. Parsnip was, you know, you could have served him as a main course and charged $25. It was delicious.
Oh my gosh, parsnips!
I know.
That's a good one. What was your what's your favorite? Did you want to read a passage from the book, or we could pick one out for the next?
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Because I think you picked out a song too that we could put on. What's the song?
This is The Barnyard Dance by Martin, Bogan, and Armstrong.
All right, we'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Okay, we're back. Chatting with Peter Kaminsky, author of Culinary Intelligence, and that's coming out tomorrow from Knopf. We had a little segment that Peter was going to read from. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, one of the things I decided to do in this book, this is not a book where it reveals that large corporations are making unconscionably huge profits on bad food. We all know that. And I am not the guy to go to who's going to give you a diet plan that says on, you know, day four, eat pressed yogurt with 3 leaves of lettuce. I like to eat spontaneously. Mm. And this is all about following pleasure informed by a little bit of knowledge. And
CI, culinary intelligence.
Say what?
CI.
So, about 40 years ago, I lived in Park Slope when it was going from borderline sketchy to borderline gentrified. And the point I was making here is it's great to know your local butcher, your local whatever, and your purveyor. And if you don't live in a neighborhood like mine, which I am blessed to live, you will be surprised if you start to talk to the people in your supermarkets. I mean, they work around food all day. And I have found if you ask them some questions, they want you to eat better. Mm-hmm. And they're happy to go along with it. But this was my guy. Years ago, but before it had gone from being marginally sketchy to entry-level gentrified, oh, that's where I just got that. I lived in Park Slope, Brooklyn. The local realtors touted it as the largest Victorian-era neighborhood in New York. Think Sesame Street with no Muppets. On Sunday mornings, I'd walk across Prospect Park and then through Kensington, a working-class neighborhood with clapboard houses from the 1920s. Because it was sheltered from the winds off the harbor and received a lot of sunlight, it was the first place in my immediate world where crocuses bloomed in the spring. After a New York winter, the sight of those tiny flowers were like a postcard from an old friend. My destination was Church Avenue in Borough Park. Whenever I took that two-mile walk, I would get a brisket from Saul Taub, who was, as his sign proclaimed in both English and Hebrew, a kosher butcher. Morning light often poured through his window. When it did, it was a good bet you'd find Saul's well-fed cat basking in the sunlight, licking his sleek and shiny coat. Being a butcher's cat is a very good gig. I'd always enter to the same scene. Sawdust on the floor. On the radio, the racist from Aqueduct called in Yiddish, Three or four wooden folding chairs, usually occupied by a lineup of old ladies, pocketbooks on their lap, intent on Saul's technique. I'd watch, too. If, while he was grinding an order of chopped meat, some of the fat that he used to push the meat through the grinder happened to emerge in long squiggles, the lady who'd placed the order would leap out of her chair like a rocketing pheasant and berate Paul for sneaking some cheap fat in place of costly meat. With an uncombative sigh and a slight smile, he'd always give the same answer to the glowering grandmas. Don't worry, I wouldn't charge extra. After I'd been his customer for 5 years, he told me the story behind the number on his tattooed wrist. I was a boy, 13 years old. The Nazis put me in a concentration camp. It was late in the war. One day we all knew the Russians were approaching the camp. You could hear their cannons. The Germans took us all outside, made us strip, and began shooting. When I heard the first shot, I fell. I pretended I was hit. The ladies piled up on top of me. Then the shooting stopped. I lay there for hours, quiet. The Russian guns grew louder. Finally, I heard soldiers speaking Russian, so I climbed out to the pile of dead bodies. It was very cold. A young Russian took off his heavy wool overcoat and gave it to me. I walked 300 miles back to Czechoslovakia. After 10 years of Saul's briskets and kosher chickens, I moved to L.A. for a few years. When I returned to New York, my brother Don and I made the long walk to Saul for old time's sake. Same old car, same cats, same old ladies, same frantic on the announcer on the radio screaming, "Er Luft wie Sekretariat," Yiddish for "he runs like Secretariat." We sat in the empty chairs at the end of the queue and worked our way forward. When it came my turn, Saul, who hadn't seen me in 2 years, went into the meat locker and emerged with a brisket. "You want I should trim the fat?" he asked.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So in case that didn't tip you off enough, this book is not your average diet book. It's not really a diet book, whatever those are. But this is a really narrative, evocative story, and you know, set in Brooklyn, you know, and elsewhere, but it's such a charming tale. And speaking of local businesses, you're doing your launch party tomorrow night at Book Court on Court Street.
Yes, the best indie bookstore in the solar system.
It's really awesome. So definitely check that out tomorrow night at Book Court at 7 p.m. and you'll hear more from Culinary Intelligence. So I got to ask this question. What is the ultimate date meal to cook at home?
Ooh, the ultimate date meal to cook at home. Well, I like clams. I like clams and wine with some parsley and garlic. I just adore that.
I have a question about clams. Is it okay to take a leftover clam, like a little castanet, and pick out the meat of another clam and use it kind of as a tongs or something and feed yourself? Is that okay?
You mean, is it elegant?
Yeah.
If you do it, yes. If I do it, no. Yeah, okay. Why not?
All right.
Why not? If it gets the food in
your
mouth.
I like it. I don't know. It's fun.
What did clam eaters do before forks? You know? My favorite date. Well, Melinda really likes a steak. A steak for two will do it. She, we'll, you know.
What's a good cut for a steak for two, by the way? Because you don't want.
Strip steak.
Okay.
Strip steak. One of the reasons I'm stuck is I cook from looking what I have and what I feel like making. Mm. So, like, last week we had some leftover radicchio. And I had some, you know, pink lentils, I had some little cherry tomatoes, the sweet ones. Mm. So I burned those tomatoes, you know, just burned them in a pan.
Okay.
So you get that elegant taste of burnt. And I sautéed the radicchio and hit it with a little balsamico at the end.
Oh.
And tossed it with the lentils, which I cooked in a little bit of stock,
mm-hmm.
and grated some Parmigiano over it. I don't know. Why did I do that? We had it. I mean, you cooked
that way,
too.
You fold in the tomatoes, too?
Yeah.
And it's colorful. Oh, man. I'm going to make that.
Yeah, deconstructing food, you know, treating each ingredient, bringing, I mean, that's the thing I've learned from working for so many chefs. Mm-hmm. One-pot meals are great. But meals where you take the separate elements and cook them in the best way for that element.
Totally.
Radicchio one way, the leeks, the lentils another. And I crisp some shallots.
Perfect for the top.
And yet you put them all together. Now, that meal costs, as Saul Talbot has said, bupkis, which is Yiddish for nothing. but it was delicious.
Yeah, lentils are really expensive these days.
Yeah.
So that's a good point, because a lot of people think that quick cooking means one pot cooking means, or maybe just leave it in a slow cooker and walk away. But this is, you know, you to spend a little bit of extra time to do the tomatoes separately and so forth separately and bring it all together. I mean, these are all quickly cooked ingredients anyway, so.
And it's exciting. I mean, I guess it's probably not as exciting
it
as the day at the races, but for me,
yeah,
it's exciting to watch each ingredient develop to its peak of flavor.
And I like a lot of pans on the stove.
Yeah.
All right,
you know,
we're agreeing on this.
The pan you did the tomatoes in, you can just put the tomatoes aside and then do the radicchio in them. You don't have to dirty up the whole kitchen.
You didn't have to. I guess it didn't take much to convince me about the points in your book, because they're just so smart. It's like, duh. It's like every passage I read was so well articulated, but it's like, exactly. That's right. So, I mean, it's a wonderful book to just read, though. I loved all your stories about, you know, catching fish and the with your daughter, and then making just the most freshest fish. It's really fun stuff to read, I gotta say. Why is there just a single red Swiss red chard on the cover?
I'm a word guy. that's what Knopf decided they liked. I like it.
I like it too. It looks so real, though. It's like, I want to touch it.
Yeah.
So it's not like Swiss chard is like the ultimate flavor per calorie.
No, but it's a darn good thing to have. I mean, I love wilting it and mixing it with beans or lentils or pasta and a little bit of bacon.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good way to... I was about to ask, how do you best cook it? But that's...
I think
perfect.
Blanch it mm-hmm. a little bit. Just blanch it.
So to wilt it.
Yeah, and then shock it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, sauté it.
So where are you taking this culinary intelligence for the book tour and, you know, events around town?
Well, I'm doing the food book fair this weekend.
Awesome.
I am cooking a whole striped bass in salt at the Orvis store on 44th Street, mm-hmm. noon on Friday. I'll be at the Rudd Center on the 11th at Yale.
Okay.
I'll be in Seattle. I'll be in San Francisco.
What's this about the White House?
Oh, well, in order to maintain my lifestyle as a freelance writer in Brooklyn, I produce some television shows. And one of them is the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, which we do at the White House. We did it with Stevie Wonder when President Obama was first
elected. So you produced this as like the producer. Wow.
And then we did Paul McCartney. And so next week we're doing Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who are particular favorites of Mrs. Obama's mom. Mm-hmm. And I think the way you're president to keep peace in the household is let your mother-in-law have her favorite music there.
That should be really fun.
Yeah. It's going to be a gas.
So this is a side gig that I guess is not that occupational hazard filled. That should be fun.
Oh, no. Well, in this White House, they're eating pretty, you know.
Yeah.
It's... we're doing with McCartney, the crew had to eat vegan.
Really?
Yeah, you know, so all these Teamsters from Washington D.C. Well, you know, anybody who's working on the gig, all the catered meals were vegan.
Okay, I'm sure they're pretty good though.
They were. I turned my nose up at it, and my nose was brought up short because it's good food.
Good stuff. That should be really fun. And congratulations on the book, too. I'm definitely looking forward to the reading and some of the other events that are going on around town. And how do you travel while eating with culinary intelligence? Are there any quick secrets?
Well,
not that much time left, but that would be good to know.
It's an exercise, you know. It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. You know, most of the time, if you stop into any chain restaurant, the trick isn't what do I want to eat? Is there anything in here I could eat?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
If you salads from fast food.
You know, the salads are going to be loaded with gloppy dressing. You know, Taco Bell, they have, you know, some fresh salsa and some real meat.
Yeah.
That's probably going to be okay. You know, Chipotle, Chipotle is good food with good ingredients. Often you don't have that choice. Often you got to stop at the 7-Eleven or, you know, the Quickie Mart and get something. And you can walk up and down those aisles for 20 minutes and you're going to walk away with a bag of almonds and some water.
Okay.
You know, and an apple. Out of season, non-local, not anything, but it's going to be better than, you know, the cheese Doritos.
Good to know.
Look for ethnic restaurants, you know, in any place where there's farmers in America now, there are grocery stores with takeout food that cater to Latinos, and that is scratch cooking from ingredients. You're going to eat better stuff than in any Cracker Barrel, with all apologies to, well, no apologies to Cracker Barrel. ethnic enclaves, by and large, are terrific. You know, there's, you know, Vietnamese in New Orleans and in Minneapolis. Those restaurants are terrific. And, you know, rather than worrying that you're going to stick out as, like, the lone whitey, I've been doing this my whole life. I've been writing about ethnic food my whole life. When you come in with a respectful attitude and ask people about their food, they like you. They like you, so it's worth it. So that's one of the tricks on the road. In airports, you're back to your, you know, bag of almonds and or, you know, mixed dried fruits, you know, with 1,400 calories. Although there are some food courts showing up in restaurants, you know, that, you know.
In airports?
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Traveling's tough.
Yeah.
Traveling's tough.
Well, thanks for those tips. That's a good one. Go find the ethnic enclaves. Every city's got one. Well, that's about all the time we've got for today. But definitely check out the culinary... culinary experience. Intelligence. Did I say experience?
You did. That's a good thing to check out. And while you're at it, read...
Have a Culinary Experience of Intelligence by Peter Kaminsky.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, everyone. Jack and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.